From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A philosopher once said, wherever there is number, there is beauty. Oh, really?
Breaking news in the $50 billion scandal that has cost thousands
Ford
of investors.
Wants a $9 billion line of credit.
State budget shortfalls will exceed $100 billion.
Unemployment is up 2 full percentage points, 43% increase. That's 2 million
jobs. Unemployment claims for benefits jumped to 573,000. That is a 26-year.
Beauty, maybe not, but confusion, bewilderment, maybe a little panic for sure. These days, there are so many numbers hurtling toward us from our imploding economy that it can be exceedingly difficult for reporters to contextualize them and for news consumers to understand them. Michael Blastland is a journalist and co-author of The Numbers Game, the common sense guide to understanding numbers in the news, in politics, and in life. Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
Can we start, please, with the $700 billion bailout?
I think the problem with that number and a lot of the numbers that are hurtling around at the moment about the American economy is that they just have a heck of a lot of zeros on the end. And probably most people's facility with numbers disappears as soon as they get to something bigger than their mortgage. What we really have to do is kind of bring it down to a level at which individuals can make some sort of sense of it. And that's really a very simple thing. We just start dividing it between all the people it's supposed to affect or all the people who are required to pay for it. Well, we have a population in the United States of about 300 million, and you come up with something like a little over $2,000 per head. Then you think, well, hey, that's I don't want to pay that. But you might also want to say, well, what's the American economy worth? And it turns out that that's around about $50,000 per head, and you look at that $2,000 in a bit, and you say, well, maybe it's not so bad, you know, and it's around about 4% we're looking at now. Maybe we can afford 4%. Maybe this isn't going to cripple the whole economy for the next 3 or 4 generations.
You've looked at the headlines swirling around the Bernard Madoff Ponzi scheme revelations, the hedge fund that collapsed, costing investors $50 billion, and say, well, you know, when you really look at that number, while it's obscene, it's not really as large as it would seem at first blush. Why is that?
I think you just have to start asking that question. What sort of context do we need to understand this number? And for particular investors, and there will be some who've been wiped out, for them, it's a 100% loss. Another piece of context, what's it going to do to the hedge fund industry? And you could say, well, it's not going to in of itself destroy the industry, but it might damage confidence. But as far as the whole American economy is concerned, it's an absolutely enormous beast, the American economy. And even $50 billion of fraud isn't going to really make any significant dent in that.
These numbers are so large as to be just dizzying. But are they also wrong?
I think some of them really are wrong and some of them are really misleading. And I just am genuinely puzzled about that because the economy is in a pretty serious state. And there's just no need to exaggerate. I'll give you an example from media here in this country. The BBC said on the news recently that the economy had ground to a halt. It kind of conjures images of the sort of rust and mass redundancy on an absolutely epic scale as the whole wheels of industry, they all grind to a stop and nothing happens. And what they'd done really is they'd kind of confused the fact that the economy wasn't getting bigger with the idea that it stopped altogether. And I think that just betrays a little bit of feverish excitement about the economy at the moment, because let's be honest, you know, it's been boring for a while. We've had a lot of steady growth for quite a long time, particularly in the United Kingdom. And, you know, the economics writers, I think, were just itching for something a little bit more tasty to get their teeth into. And along it comes, and they just can't help themselves.
One of the reasons that journalists love to use numbers is because they at least seem so definitive. They seem real. Often what we're talking about is so elusive.
Yep.
But that definitiveness is sometimes an illusion, I gather.
I think you're absolutely right. As journalists, we're looking for the killer fact, that sort of certain bit of data that you can put in the headline and it seems to capture everything important that you need to know right now. And invariably, that killer fact is a number. This harkens back to a very old tradition, a Platonic idea, that numbers capture an eternal truth about the world. just as we learnt in math in kindergarten or, you know, our first schools, they have an absolute correlation to real things. The problem is that when you grow up, you realise that these numbers, these things that we're going out there to try and count, are much softer, much more imprecise.
Now, Michael, I've known you now for, you know, something like 10 minutes, and I believe that on the basis of that, I can really unload on you. And I'm going to tell you one of my deepest, darkest hatreds, and that is news stories that, quote, economists are saying such and such will cost the economy an estimated $4 billion. Traffic jams cost the economy $4 billion. Schizophrenia cost the economy $206.3 trillion and so forth and so on. And if you start adding up all of the costs to the economy of the various diseases and dysfunctions, you know, we have a negative economy by something like $46 quadrillion.
There is a certain class of numerical gibberish where I think all we're really doing is using this thing as an excuse to talk about some issue, you know. And it doesn't really matter that much, frankly, whether the numbers make any sense whatsoever. And very often they don't. And as you say, if only we didn't have any traffic jams, you know, and if only we didn't get sick, and if only there was no graffiti, and, you know, if all these things that cost us money weren't there, well, heck, we could all retire tomorrow, you know. And then it doesn't quite work like that, I don't think.
Well, Michael, I want to tell you, this was 36% better a conversation than I had expected. So thank you very much.
Okay. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Michael Blastland is a journalist and co-author of The Numbers Game, The Common Sense Guide to Understanding Numbers in the News, in Politics, and in Life.
News happening now. An Iraqi man threw his shoes at President Bush during a news conference.
An Iraqi journalist hurled one and then another shoe at the
president. The shoe thrower yelled in Arabic, "This is a farewell, dog."
A guy throws his shoes at George W. Bush. In the midst of war and staggering economic news, what an odd little story to dominate the headlines for 3 days. But the target was the President of the United States. The incident was rich with subtext. And most of all, it was all on tape. Like the Zapruder film, only non-lethal. Wow, nice reflexes, Mr. President. The New York Post headline was "Lame Duck," but I beg to differ. This was one of the few times in 8 years when Bush didn't look awkward at the podium. His missile defense system should only be that nimble. Oh, and a little deflective humor, too. All I can report is, deadpan Bush, it is a size 10. Ha ha ha. So, yeah, comedy? Check. Man bites dog? Check. Man calls president dog? Check. Suitable for slow-mo? Double super check. But none of that is why this episode will live forever, nor even the brazenness of the attack smacking a sea of press and Secret Service. Sure wasn't the journalistic angle, despite a fairly severe breach of decorum. I mean, just think of Dan Rather.
Are you running for something? No, sir, Mr. President, are you?
The CBS newsman became a public enemy in some circles for merely talking back to President Nixon. Media etiquette-wise, winging footwear is definitely a press conference don't. But this barely seemed to register. Even the media focused less on their colleague, the culprit, than on his weapon.
In much of the Muslim world, throwing a shoe at somebody is considered the worst possible nonviolent insult. It shows extreme disrespect and contempt.
They say there literally could not be a more insulting gesture in the Muslim world than to be assaulted with one's shoe.
The shoe is considered something that's unclean in Iraq and across the Muslim world.
Uh-huh. Whereas in France and Cambodia and Iceland, throwing shoes at someone's head is what, a compliment? Okay, so now we know that the gesture was not mere insult, but extreme insult. The kind of breathless attention to a minor detail that might have obscured the most significant part of the episode, but it could not. Not even the most pernicious media filter, its own triviality, could filter out the real story. The tape told it plainly. A working journalist, not a Ba'athist insurgent, not a Shiite cleric, not a foreign jihadist, but a journalist, was finally so outraged by the blood and chaos visited upon his country that Muntadhar al-Zaidi lashed out at the most powerful man in the world at who knew what cost to his career and personal safety. Maybe he guessed that he would become a hero throughout the Arab world, but he could just as easily wind up a martyr. His family has said he's already been severely beaten in prison. What would make him risk everything? The answer was immediately forthcoming, provided, generously enough, by the president himself.
And the guy wanted to get on TV, and he did. I don't know what his beef is.
He doesn't know. Exactly. Here was George Bush for one last photo op in what he sees as a fertile crescent of Arab democracy and what most Iraqis see as the ruins of their society. As if to underline the very self-delusion and denial that so infuriated his attacker, the president depicted the incident as an illustrious emblem of freedom. Here he was with CNN's Candy Crowley.
I believe that a free society is emerging, and a free society is necessary for our own security and peace.
Not an unexpected reply from the president, who minutes later would deny once again that waterboarding is torture or its use against the law. More surprising, actually, was Crowley's question, which framed the shoe assault as a display of Iraqi ingratitude.
Was there ever a part of you that in reflection went, wait a second, we have poured billions of dollars, not to mention U.S. blood and treasure, into this country? How dare this guy, even if he's a single guy?
Was she just baiting Bush or expressing her own patriotic resentment? It was impossible to tell. What was clear was that the odd little shoe incident was so much more than man bites president. It was a video apotheosis, high drama disguised as low comedy, cathartic, illuminating, and, I promise you, iconic. If you believe in constructing your presidential legacy with indelible images, well, mission accomplished.
Coming up, a peek at how information may or may not flow from the Obama White House.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every presidency has multiple legacies: Supreme Court appointees, key legislation, and political phrases. Yep, the bully pulpit is a great place to seize semantic control of the debate, a point that was not lost on the Bush administration. It actually began before he took office.
I call my philosophy and approach compassionate conservatism.
We should have known then that we were in store for some serious political rebranding. Early on, legislation to increase logging was christened the Healthy Forests Initiative. Who could be against a healthy forest? Nor does anyone want to leave children behind or oppose clean skies. But Bush branded more than just legislation. There was the Department of Homeland Security, the Axis of Evil, and the war in Iraq, officially known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. And while a good name can't always change public perception, word swapping does have legal benefits. If you call a prisoner of war an enemy combatant, they don't have the same rights. Press Secretary Scott McClellan explained this in 2003 when confronted with a report from the Red Cross objecting to the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo.
Let's remember, these individuals are enemy combatants during a time of war, and the President of the United States is committed to do everything we can to protect the American people from future attacks. And part of that is the information we're obtaining from these enemy combatants.
And if you're wondering how they obtain that information, don't. The Bush administration assured us over and over that since the United States does not torture, anything we do by definition is just enhanced interrogation. But with Bush leaving office in a month, do all those redefinitions and catchy terms get called home like ambassadors whose stints abroad have ended? Or do they just, like Supreme Court justices, live on and on and on? Frank Luntz, Republican pollster and phrasemaker of great renown, has an answer to that question. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So we saw you in the new War Room documentary where you said you were inspired by the Clinton administration's linguistic successes to do the same for the other side. And clearly you've succeeded popularizing terms like the death tax instead of the estate tax and climate change instead of global warming. So first off, do you think that 8 years of Bush have been able to undo any of the language that came from 8 years of Clinton?
I don't think that George W. Bush will have the same linguistic impact on the American people that Bill Clinton did, because, quite frankly, Clinton was a better communicator. He felt people's pain. He understood how to reach them, even in the tone, even in not just the phrasing, but the way he delivered. His voice would get kind of just a little bit hoarse, and it would shake just a little bit. And that told you that he really was trying to get personal with you.
You know people who lost their jobs,
yeah,
lost their homes?
Uh-huh.
Well, I've been governor of a small state for 12 years. I'll tell you how it's affected me. In my state, when people lose their jobs, there's a good chance I'll know them by their names. When a factory closes, I know the people who ran it. When the businesses go bankrupt, I know them.
He's a master at it. And George W. Bush just wasn't the communicator that Bill Clinton was.
Well, now you're talking about delivery. What about the phrases themselves? What are the Clintonian locutions that stick in your mind as masterful?
Well, I still remember how he was the first person to turn spending into investment, and now everybody does it. You'll never hear Barack Obama using the word spending. Everything, every amount that the government now spends is an investment. And the other thing about Clinton was that he called for an end to welfare as we know it, and yet he increased spending on the poor. So that this is someone who understood where the American people were at, and he just found good ways of reaching us.
So what are some of the linguistic switcheroos executed by the Bush administration that you think may outlive his presidency?
I don't think all that much of George Bush's linguistic mastery will live beyond him. The problem with Bush is that he talked about privatizing Social Security before he talked about personalizing it, so that undermined that way of articulating. He talked about a bailout rather than calling it a recovery plan or a rescue plan. He talked about a surge in Iraq rather than calling it a realignment and reassessment.
I thought the surge was regarded as generally a good term.
The surge was regarded as a good strategy. It was not regarded as a good term, because it focused on troops and only the number of troops rather than a whole reassessment of the strategy. And I think that the word surge actually undermined his ability to communicate his position on Iraq.
Well, what do you think about the phrase war on terror? I know that the administration fiddled around with some other names briefly, struggle against violent extremism, the long war. None of those really stuck. Do you expect that President Obama will use war on terror in his speeches, or do you anticipate a rebranding?
I think that he will engage in a rebranding and a rephraseology of the political lexicon. And I expect Obama also to have the potential to create a lexicon that outlives his presidency. He understands how to say things that don't really tell you exactly where he stands, but makes you connect with him and makes you want him to succeed.
But have you heard any phrases yet that seem to be sticky?
Well, yeah. When Barack Obama says this is not an election about Republicans versus Democrats or left versus right or young versus old.
Together, ordinary people can do extraordinary things, because we are not a collection of red states and blue states. We are the United States of America.
That phraseology, that context setting, I think is one of the reasons why he was successful in the campaign.
Now, obviously, the bully pulpit is a great place from which to install a new phrase. Do you think that inevitably, if a president repeats a term over and over, that it automatically enters the popular lexicon?
I don't believe it's the repetition. I believe it's the creativity. Ask not what your country can do for you was spoken once and was never forgotten. All we have to fear is fear itself. Again, a single utterance, or December 7th, a day that'll live in infamy. Infamy was not a traditional, typical word in the American lexicon in 1941. The only way that a word actually goes from being a traditional expressive word to something that we pick up is if it's out of the ordinary. They've got to deliver them in a powerful way that grabs us and doesn't let go. Infamy is that kind of word.
But investment isn't. I mean, saying investment instead of spending is a clever way of reframing the debate, but it isn't as if you're using an unusual word.
No, but in that case, it's that Bill Clinton used the word investment again and again and again and again and again. And he actually would say publicly, I'm not asking for additional dollars. This is not more wasteful Washington spending. This is an investment in our children, an investment in the future. So he was actually using a very plain pedestrian word and trying to soup it up by what it was for rather than trying to score with the word itself.
I was trying to come up with some Republican phrases that didn't quite stick this time around, and what I came up with was Islamofascist and the Democrat Party.
Well, Islamofascist was never going to work, and I know that a bunch of politicians tried desperately to get that word to enter into the lexicon, and it doesn't roll off the tongue. You're combining one principle from today's world with another one that people more associate with World War II. And it didn't sound right. It didn't register. And then as far as the Democrat Party, that was something that Ronald Reagan did back in the 1980s. Bush tried to do it this time. That is an example of much ado about nothing. It doesn't change the public's perception of the people you're speaking of or the political policies. It doesn't change voters' intent. So much was written about that on the blogs, and I kind of felt sorry for people because they were really wasting their time.
Looking forward, the Democratic Party has apparently done away with economic stimulus for the less technical and more hopeful-sounding term, economic recovery. If you can put yourself in their shoes for a second, what are the biggest challenges that the Democratic Party faces when it comes to language?
The challenge for them is not to overpromise and use language that makes people feel more hopeful and more secure without getting them to believe that tomorrow, happy days will be here again, because we know they won't.
Can you think of any phrases that can summon up those two perhaps conflicting ideas?
Obama used a word in the convention speech. It was a single word after giving a litany of what had happened in America. And in that one word, he articulated what everyone felt at that moment. He said, enough.
Tonight I say to the people of America, to Democrats and Republicans and independents across this great land, enough! This moment.
He didn't repeat it. He stopped. And I looked around and everyone was nodding. It touched exactly how they felt. But for the most part, it's very hard to soundbite him because he talks in much more general principles. They're very unifying. Nobody remembers a specific word or phrase from his speech the night of the election when he accepted the victory. But everybody remembers what a great speech that was. That's going to be typical of Obama over the next 4 years. They won't remember a specific word or phrase, but they will remember a speech and they will think to themselves, you know what? He touched me there.
Frank, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Frank Luntz is a Republican pollster and author of Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear.
This week, President-elect Obama continued unveiling nominees for cabinet positions and top economic posts. But one of the first positions he announced just days after the election was that of press secretary, Robert Gibbs. Gibbs came on board Obama's campaign for Senate in 2004 after quitting the John Kerry presidential race. Since then, he's been Obama's right-hand man on issues ranging from messaging strategies to deliberations on fantasy football. The native Alabaman, a proud member of Rednecks for Obama, is known for being a lot disorganized and at least a little confrontational. Reporter Mark Leibovich wrote about Gibbs for this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, and he asked Obama who Gibbs is most like from the president-elect's favorite movie, which is The Godfather. First, he answered the consigliere character, Tom Hagen, played by Robert Duvall. But, Leibovich says, Obama thought about it a little longer and...
He said, you know, I've seen a little bit of Sonny in Robert also, and I wanted to inform readers or remind readers that Sonny was in fact a murderous hothead, but they thought it would be gratuitous.
They let it just stand as if it were understood by everybody. It's certainly understood by me because I remember a number of little flaps during the campaign where hothead seemed to be just the right description.
Although we should say Gibbs has never been accused of being murderous.
Okay, noted.
He's very backslappery in the day-to-day, and he talks about sports, and he's very funny. He can crack jokes. But he will get in your face. He had this fairly memorable tête-à-tête with Sean Hannity after one of the debates in which Hannity was bringing up questions about Obama and Bill Ayers. And Gibbs came back at him and accused him of being an anti-Semite because I guess Hannity had had an anti-Semite or got someone who's been accused thereof on the show a couple of days earlier.
Are you anti-Semitic?
Not at all.
Okay. On your show on Sunday, the centerpiece of that show was a guy named Andy Martin.
I know you're reading your talking points.
Andy Martin called the judge a crooked, slimy Jew who has a history of lying and thieving common to
members
of his race.
Here's my answer to you.
But wait a minute.
We put it's Malik Shabazz on the show.
Why am I not to believe that everybody that works for the network is anti-Semitic?
So that was, you know, YouTube gold.
Okay, but tell me about when he's gone after not Sean Hannity, but reporters merely having the misfortune to represent news organizations that had disappointed the campaign.
There have been several instances over the course of the campaign, or were several instances over the course of the campaign, in which reporters, by their telling, were kept off the campaign plane because of either negative things that they have written or things that their news outlet did, i.e. endorsing John McCain. Now, the campaign strenuously denies that they have ever kicked anyone off the plane for reasons other than space issues. But then when I pressed Robert, he said, sure, occasionally it does happen. So the whole Obama conceit is we are transparent, we are open, we are service with a smile. But Gibbs is very much the old school sort of bad cop.
You pointed out in your piece that we can expect message discipline in the Obama White House, not dissimilar to the message discipline enforced during the Bush administration.
David Plouffe, the Obama campaign manager, explicitly told me that we followed the Bush model when it comes to message discipline. The Blagojevich scandal is kind of a case in point. I mean, on one hand, they are saying, you know, we are going to release details of every conversation our staff has had with the governor. But on the other hand, Obama has been fairly testy when questioned on this. On Tuesday, during a press conference, Barack Obama was questioned by John McCormick of the Chicago Tribune about just this, and he was very testy.
Over the weekend, the Tribune reported that Rahm Emanuel, your incoming chief of staff, had presented a list of potential names that—
John, let me just cut you off, because I don't want you to waste your question. As I indicated yesterday, we've done a full review of this. The facts are going to be released next week. It would be inappropriate for me to comment. Because, for example, the story that you just talked about in your own paper, I haven't confirmed that it was accurate, and I don't want to get into the details at this point. So do you have another question?
They want to control information as much as any other White House has, and I think that that's important to remember. And, you know, for as much high-tech innovation, you know, putting the weekly radio address on YouTube and sending text messages out to a zillion people to tell them who the new cabinet something is. I mean, this is a very, very old school way of how White Houses communicate with the press.
In the beginning of your piece, you were talking about the pride the campaign takes in being outsiders, that they're actually kind of laughing at the inside the Beltway media elites.
Right. I was amazed at how open they were in their sort of post-election disdain for the quote-unquote chattering classes of Washington. I mean, David Plouffe, the campaign manager, said, if the Politico and the Page, this is the Time magazine sort of tip sheet, if they say we're up, we're down, or if they say we're winning, we're losing. And, you know, one of the things the Obama campaign boasted about is that they never did an editorial board meeting with the Washington Post, which would have been unheard of in previous campaigns and probably was pretty smart because, as Gibbs said, there aren't a lot of people in Waterloo, Iowa reading the Washington Post. However, when you are in Washington, your constituencies are different. I mean, there are, you know, 400 members of Congress, I'd venture, who are reading the Washington Post. You know, I assume they're smart enough to realize that, but I was sort of surprised by how far they seem to be continuing to take the sort of we know a better way to reach people than to dealing with the same media suspects.
Let's come back to Gibbs for a moment. You pointed out in your piece that he will have the advantage on the podium of not being just a mouthpiece for the president, but also an advisor, very much in the inner circle But you also observe that that can come back to haunt a spokesman and his boss.
Robert Gibbs conceivably could be privy to more information about what the president is thinking about, how he thinks about things, the president's history, than any spokesman in a long, long time. And when you have that institutional knowledge, it certainly enhances the authority with which you can speak from the podium. But at the same time, there will be many more occasions when he cannot convincingly say, I'm not aware, or I don't know, or basically, knowledge can be a very dangerous thing at that podium. And when you have knowledge, you have more to lie about or more to obfuscate about. And that's sort of the basic physics of information. All things being equal, it will be nice to have a spokesman who knows a lot. But the question is, will this only make him all the more careful and all the more scripted?
Well, Mark, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Mark Leibovich is a national political reporter for the New York Times. His piece, Between Obama and the Press, is in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine.
Coming up, what we really ought to mean when we say Orwellian.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's that time of year again, the season of the presidential pardon. As time runs out for the Bush administration, the press and the public await word on who will win a get-out-of-jail-free card from the president. Nothing, I mean nothing, says absolute power like the presidential pardon. No congressional override, no amount of media scrutiny, no public outcry can undo this one truly discretionary decision of the president. It might be why pardons still bother the public and fascinate the press.
We know Alaska Senator Ted Stevens has not asked for one, but there are some other big names out there, including Duke Cunningham.
Junk bond king Michael Milken, media mogul Conrad Black, American-born Taliban soldier John Walker Lynn. Remember him?
President Carter gave one to Vietnam draft dodgers. President Jackson gave one to the Confederacy. President Washington gave one to the fighters in the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion.
P.S. Ruckman Jr. is editor of the Pardon Power blog and author of the forthcoming book, Pardon Me, Mr. President, Adventures in Crime, Politics, and Mercy. He says that since the drafting of the Constitution, the pardon has been much used and little understood.
There's a formal process where you send an application to the Department of Justice, which forwards it to the Office of the Pardon Attorney, who works with the FBI to look at character references, to check criminal records and that type of thing. And then a recommendation is made to the Deputy Attorney General, who then makes a recommendation to the President. But all of that can be bypassed by talking directly to the President, the President's wife, or best friend of a President, or meeting someone at a cocktail party who has access to the President.
Now, there have been some notorious pardons, right? Mafiosi, mass murderers, co-conspirators in the Lincoln assassination. Can you go through a few?
Sure. The gentleman who hatched the plots from the back of Ford Theater, the gentleman who held the door open for John Wilkes Booth to escape, and the doctor who set John Wilkes Booth legged once he traveled down the road, all of them were recipients of federal executive clemency. In modern times, Oscar Collazo, who attempted to assassinate Harry Truman and almost succeeded, his sentence was commuted by Truman. He was sentenced to death originally. And then Jimmy Carter commuted it again, so he was set free. But yes, mass murderers, axe murderers, vampires, you name it.
Vampires?
The list is, Ulysses Grant pardoned a Portuguese sailor who was found in the hull of a ship sucking blood out of lifeless bodies. And he was sentenced to be executed. Maybe people were curious just to see if he could be executed. Grant commuted the sentence to life in prison. And the gentleman went on to kill a few more people when he was in prison. So it wasn't a very good PR kind of pardon.
Is there some general reason why these guys were let off?
No, it's just a fascinating tale, I would say, behind each and every story. I think of Lupo the Wolf or Ignacio Saietti, who was in New York City and linked to the so-called murder stable, where 60 people were one at a time tortured and murdered. How a person like that could be the recipient of any form of executive clemency is just mind-boggling, but he was. And there's a very intricate story behind it.
The reason why we want to hear about pardons, I assume, is because they capture the public imagination in some way.
Yeah, I think so. I think acts of mercy in general have a fascinating quality about them.
The power of life and death in one person's hands, it's more suggestive of the divine right of kings than of the democratic rule of law. And I know that Thurgood Marshall wrote a famous dissent about the whole pardon process.
Yes, he did. He takes a view which is that the Supreme Court has misinterpreted the power and made it equal to, if not greater than, that of the King of England. And what Marshall argued in his dissent, and by the way, he's bouncing off another opinion by Justice Holmes written in the early 1900s, is that the power should be interpreted in terms of the Constitution and the Republic, where we have separation of powers and checks and balances. And so our president should not have that power.
You suggest that modern administrations have been more secretive about the pardon process than earlier administrations in our country's life. How come, and what do you think the consequences of that are?
The transition from the Truman administration to the Eisenhower administration serves as a good vehicle for understanding this. A congressman noticed that someone was pardoned toward the end of the Truman administration, and he asked the Office of the Pardoning Attorney for a list of persons who had been pardoned between the election and the end of Truman's term. And then lo and behold, there were 20-something persons and some fairly famous persons, and their applications didn't go through the normal processes. So now suddenly you had kind of this scandal. Eisenhower came into office promising to avoid secrecy, but very quickly he took on a policy which presidents to this day have generally followed. If someone applies, it's a secret. You know, if you ask the Office of the Pardoning Attorney today who has applied, they will not tell you. Now, if you have a particular person's name in your mind and you ask them, has so-and-so applied, they will confirm that. And then who's supporting the application is none of your business as far as the Office of the Pardoning Attorney is concerned. And what the arguments are that they're making for the clemency, all that's considered private information. The best you can do is, after the pardon is granted, maybe to do a FOIA request and get a bunch of redacted material.
You say that every generation has a pardon that they can never forget.
Well, there's a pardon that appears, if not a couple, which at the time is treated like this is the end-all act of clemency. You know, nothing can get more bizarre or controversial than this. And in fact, in just a matter of years, it's completely off of the map. And so when Charles Morse, for example, who almost wrecked Wall Street in the early 1900s, drank a soapy concoction to simulate death and got a deathbed pardon, then went home and got well and outlived the president who pardoned him. At the time, that was the biggest darn thing that ever happened in the history of pardons. But today, if you ask someone who's Charles W. Morse, no one has any idea.
Don't you think that we as Americans ought to be offended by the very idea of pardons?
No, that's a great question, but I could not disagree more. Because there's a long-standing recognition that the law can be too rigid, it cannot cover every circumstance, and the pardon power is there to serve as a safety valve for those circumstances where the written law, if you will, just doesn't understand. And I think today when you look at the fact that mandatory minimum sentences are really locking in the discretion of judges, and you realize, wow, we need the pardon power really more than ever. And since the Law and Order campaigns of Richard Nixon, you know, criminals haven't been as popular as they used to be. That get tough on crime attitude, you know, if you will, that's out there.
And so we like reading about pardons, writing about pardons, because they're guaranteed to make us mad.
I believe so.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
P.S. Ruckman Jr., editor of the Pardon Power blog and author of the forthcoming book, Pardon Me, Mr. President, Adventures in Crime, Politics, and Mercy. Here's a passage from George Orwell's The Sporting Spirit, originally published in the London Tribune in December 1945. Serious sport has nothing to do with fair play. It is bound up with hatred, jealousy, boastfulness, disregard of all rules, and sadistic pleasure in witnessing violence. In other words, it is war minus the shooting. New Yorker staff writer George Packer says Orwell's essays are where one finds the real Orwell, Orwell at his most Orwellian.
And so, Packer has assembled a collection of his favorites in two volumes, Facing Unpleasant Facts and All Art is Propaganda, published this fall. Now, many of us never got past 1984 and Animal Farm, longtime staples of the high school curriculum, and that's a shame because, as Packer observes, the term Orwellian has become synonymous with dark depictions of government eavesdropping and mind control, when the word should, in fact, conjure up the clarity and power of Orwell's prose.
To me, Orwellian is the quality of his thinking and his voice on the page. It's so direct. It is so much a recognizable human voice speaking quite intimately, quite directly to the reader, and never more so than in these essays, because that's where you find Orwell in his irascibility, his exaggerations, his poignancy, his wit. So it's the fullest Orwell, the most Orwellian Orwell in the essays.
In that list, you might also add his range. He didn't just talk politics by any means.
He wrote about being a homeless guy in a shelter. He wrote about being a colonial policeman in Burma. He wrote about a good cup of tea. He wrote about English cooking. He wrote about the return of spring. He wrote about Gandhi. He wrote about Kipling. He wrote about T.S. Eliot. He wrote about cigarettes. He wrote about book reviewing. It sounds like a kind of a random compendium of interest. It's not. They really do come together in these volumes. And I think the key to them is he's always interested in the sort of moral and social consequences of the subjects that he's taking up. It's never a free ride. It's never just for fun. I mean, even his essay on sort of pornographic postcards that were sold at the seaside in his youth has a point, a pretty powerful point about the need for human beings to have both a higher and lower self, a Don Quixote and a Sancho Panza, as he says in the essay.
You know, the Cliff Notes version of Orwell is of a political ideologue always rallying against totalitarianism and always for his beloved democratic socialism. That's an impression certainly you draw from his novels. But what about his essays? Were his politics fully formed from the start? Can you cite an essay in which he expresses doubt or admits a mistake?
I think the key essay for this, and it's in the volume of narrative essays called Facing Unpleasant Facts, and that title comes from an essay called Why I Write, which is his clearest statement of what his purpose is as a writer. And in it, he describes how his coming to political consciousness was kind of slow. He started out wanting to be a novelist, basically wanting to be a 19th century novelist. Dickens was his hero. But events such as the Depression of the 30s, the Spanish Civil War, World War II, the rise of fascism and communism sort of pushed him into political writing, and that's where he really shone. He's always the observer who, you know, misses nothing and sees these little moments that capture a whole world. I mean, in a hanging, for example, he is one of a party of executioners escorting a Burmese prisoner to the gallows, doing their job, except at one moment the prisoner steps aside to avoid a puddle in their path, and that's the moment when it turns into a great essay, because it's then that Orwell suddenly realizes they're about to kill a living man and what that means. So that's the trademark of his narrative essays, are those moments when a small observation leads him to some rather large and powerful thought.
And in that instance, of course, he didn't set that situation up, but it's fair to say that several times he did. I mean, in The Spike, he was tramping along the roads to stay in these shelters with actual unemployed, poverty-stricken humanity. He didn't have to be there. And in another essay, he explicitly sets out to get himself arrested by being drunk and disorderly.
Yeah, that one's called Clink. It was never published, but it's one of my favorites because it's just this long, crazy account of a night spent trying to get really drunk and get thrown into jail, which he succeeded in doing, at least for a short time. That period of his life is very strange and hard to understand. And the best I can say is he came back from Burma guilt-ridden about having been in the business of executing Burmese prisoners, etc. And he had to expiate it somehow, and he did it by identifying with the dregs, with the submerged classes. But I think what's wonderful about the essays in these two volumes is they're about so many other things. There's an essay called The Case for the Open Fire. You know, that's Orwell's sort of the reactionary, the guy who really didn't love the age of the machine and who kind of wanted the England of his childhood where everyone sat around the coal fire and read the newspaper to each other.
You say that Orwell spent a lot of his time trying to distance himself from a privileged childhood, and he called out his fellow writers in more than one essay for being out of touch with the common man.
Well, he was at a class level where he was acutely aware of class. That is to say, he was not upper class, but he really wasn't lower even middle. He was what he once called the lower upper middle class, which means kind of sliding down from the level at which his family had been accustomed to living and full of the anxieties and terrors of that position. And what he did in his life, which is unusual, is he decided to slide down even farther. He assumed the guise of a tramp, of a dishwasher in a Parisian restaurant. He went down coal mines. He fought in the Spanish Civil War in the trenches. He was not just signing pamphlets like W.H. Auden and Stephen Spender, whom he liked to call the pansy left, not very nicely. Orwell was quite tough and even brutal in some ways. And over again, he insulted them, sometimes justifiably, sometimes not, but I think out of the resentment and envy of someone both less privileged and less successful. In his 40s, which was the 1940s, he became a famous writer, and his essays became less cantankerous and more generous and actually more upbeat. I mean, even as he was writing 1984, he was also writing little essays like Some Thoughts on the Common Toad, which is an essay about the return of spring and how it's free and the dictators and the bureaucrats can't keep you from enjoying it. So it's as if he was able to celebrate life a little bit more, even as he was dying of tuberculosis and writing the bleakest novel of the 20th century, 1984.
In Such Were the Joys, he talks about his youth and his experiences in public school. Do you want to read from that?
This is at the beginning. He has just been summoned to the headmaster's office. He's age 7. He is going to be punished for the crime of wetting his bed repeatedly. When he's flogged, he doesn't cry. And in fact, he even sort of says to another schoolboy, "Didn't hurt," which prompts the headmaster to summon him again for another more brutal flogging, which causes the riding crop to break across the Orwellian buttocks and fly across the room. And here's what follows. "I had fallen into a chair, weakly sniveling. I remember that this was the only time throughout my boyhood when a beating actually reduced me to tears, and curiously enough, I was not even now crying because of the pain. The second beating had not hurt very much either. Fright and shame seemed to have anesthetized me. I was crying partly because I felt that this was expected of me, partly from genuine repentance, but partly also because of a deeper grief which is peculiar to childhood and not easy to convey, a sense of desolate loneliness and helplessness, of being locked up, not only in a hostile world, but in a world of good and evil where the rules were such that it was actually not possible for me to keep them." You've got this powerful but rather simple incident, and then this amazing opening out to a statement about the world of a child, which is the mark of a great essayist.
George, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
New Yorker staff writer George Packer edited 2 collections of Orwell's essays, Facing Unpleasant Facts and All Art is Propaganda. To hear more of our conversation about Orwell, go to onthemedia.org. And finally, the most famous anonymous source in modern history died Thursday. Deep Throat, the garage freak, Mark Felt, if you prefer, will always be remembered for his role in bringing down the Nixon administration. The Deep Throat, depicted by Hal Holbrook and all the president's men lurking in the shadows of an underground garage, was a cynic who found Nixon's penchant for secrecy, spying, and strong-arming contemptible. But Felt wasn't Deep Throat. Sure, he was Bob Woodward's source, and sometimes they met in a garage, but he wasn't a cynic. He was an FBI guy. In his memoir, A G-Man's Life, he writes of having been denounced when the Nixon administration came in as being too much the Hooverite, overly attached to Hoover's leadership style, his secrecy, spying, and strong-arming. But Felt said Hoover used those tactics to protect the FBI's good name, while Nixon wanted to turn the agency into a political tool. Mark Felt was instrumental in bringing down a criminal presidency, but he was no standard-bearer for transparency. He was fine with Nixon's methods. He just didn't want Nixon to use them.
That's it for this week's show on the media. It was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prechep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting the New York Philharmonic New Year's Eve concert with mezzo-soprano Susan Graham on December 31st, hosted by Renee Fleming. On the Media is also supported by the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.